TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
In October of 1998, Lawrence Ferlinghetti became the first poet laureate of the city of San Francisco. Mayor Willie Brown said he got the idea during a visit to Seoul, South Korea. He had been asked when the city's poet laureate would be giving his annual talk. A decision had to be made very fast to create the office, and as city librarian Regina Minuti said, picking Lawrence Ferlinghetti was a no-brainer. She introduced him as a literary legend, a voice of dissent, and an internationally acclaimed writer, artist, bookseller, and publisher. For the friends and neighbors who crowded into the library auditorium after having happily participated in the reception, where wine was flowing freely, it was a no-brainer as well. Here was their neighbor and colleague, someone who had been a close friend for many, for almost half a century, since he first moved to San Francisco. Ferlinghetti is known to everybody in the streets of North Beach, from his daily walks, from his modest second-floor flat, to his roll-top desk in the publishing office of City Lights, always with coins in his pockets to give away. On his desk, he finds as many requests to sign petitions as manuscripts for publication, and he obliges many, and even walks on picket lines. So North Beach was piled into the auditorium to see one of their own honored that night, when Lawrence Ferlinghetti gave one of the more unusual acceptance speeches for a city poet laureate, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
I see the mayor got a little extra soul in Seoul, Korea, and appointed me mayor. Let that one go. Inasmuch as I'm in competition with the league championship, the Yankees versus the Indians, I've got to read my baseball canto. From another era, as you'll see. Watching baseball, sitting in the sun, eating popcorn, reading Ezra Pound, and wishing Juan Marichal would hit a hole right through the Anglo-Saxon tradition in the first canto and demolish the barbarian invaders from Los Angeles. When the San Francisco Giants take the field and everybody stands up to the national anthem with some Irish tenor's voice piped over the loudspeakers, with all the players struck dead in their places and the white umpires like Irish cops in their black suits and little black caps pressed over their hearts, standing straight and still like at some funeral of a Blarney bartender, and all facing east as if expecting some great white hope or the founding fathers to appear on the horizon. But Willie Mays appears instead in the bottom of the first, and a roar goes up as he clouts the first one into the sun and takes off like a foot runner from Thebes. The ball is lost in the sun and maidens wail after him, but he keeps running through the Anglo-Saxon epic. And Tito Fuentes comes up looking like a bullfighter in his tight pants and small pointed shoes. And the right field bleachers go mad with Chicanos and blacks and Brooklyn beer drinkers. Sweet Tito! Saque to him, sweet Tito! And sweet Tito puts his foot in the bucket and smacks one that don't come back at all. And flees around the bases like he's escaping from the United Fruit Company. As the gringo dollar beats out the pound, and sweet Tito beats it out like he's beating out usury, not to mention fascism and anti-Semitism. And Juan Marichal comes up, and the Chicano bleachers go loco again as Juan belts the first fastball out of sight and rounds first and keeps going, and rounds second and rounds third and keeps going and hits pay dirt to the roars of the grungy populace. As some nut presses the backstage panic button for the tape-recorded national anthem again to save the situation. But it don't stop nobody this time in their revolution around the loaded white bases. in this last of the great Anglo-Saxon epics in the Territorio Libre of baseball. Well, now comes the hard part of the performance, reading prose. Poetry and City Culture. I certainly was surprised to be named Poet Laureate of this far-out city on the left side of the world. And I gratefully accept. For as I told the mayor, how could I refuse? I'd rather be Poet Laureate of San Francisco than anywhere, because this city has always been a poetic center, a frontier for free poetic life, with perhaps more poets and more poetry readers than any place in the world, than any city in the world. But we are in danger of losing it. In fact, we are in danger of losing much more than that. All that made this city so unique in the first place seems to be going down the tube at an alarming rate. The Bay Guardian's issue this week is really extraordinary. A 4-month survey in detail of what I'm talking about, showing a transformation from a diverse metropolis that welcomed immigrants and refugees from around the world to a homogeneous, wealthy enclave. The gap between the rich and the poor in San Francisco increased more than 40% in 2 years recently. San Francisco may soon become the first fully gentrified city in America, the urban equivalent of a gated bedroom community, says Daniel Zoll in The Guardian. Now it's becoming almost impossible for a lot of the people who have made this such a world-class city, people who have been the heart and soul of the city for decades, from the fishers and pasta makers and blue-collar workers to the jazz musicians to the beat poets to the hippies to the punks and so many others, to exist here anymore. And when you've lost that part of the city, you've lost San Francisco, unquote. And Richard Walker, head of geography at UC Berkeley, said, it means a one-dimensional city, just another American city, a corporate city, a fate it has resisted for generations, unquote. When I arrived in the city in 1950, I came overland by train and took the ferry from the Oakland Mole to the ferry building, and San Francisco looked like some Mediterranean port with mostly white buildings, a little like Tunis, seen from seaward. I thought perhaps it was Atlantis, risen from the sea. I certainly saw North Beach, especially as a poetic place, as poetic as any place where great poets and painters had found inspiration. And this was the first poem I wrote here, a North Beach scene. Away above a harbor full of caulkless houses, among the Charlie Noble chimney pots of a rooftop rigged with clotheslines, a woman paced up sails upon the wind, hanging out her morning sheets with wooden pins. Oh, lovely mammal, her nearly naked breasts throw taut shadows as she stretches up to hang at last the last of her so whitewashed sins. But it is wetly amorous and winds itself about her, clinging to her skin. So caught with arms upraised, she tosses back her head in voiceless laughter, and in choiceless gesture then shakes out gold hair. While in the reachless seascape spaces between the blown white shrouds stand out the bright steamers to kingdom come. This past weekend, North Beach looked like a theme park, literally overrun by tourists, and kitsch was king. What happened to North Beach? Just as an example of one neighborhood. What makes for a free poetic life? What destroys the poetry of a city? Automobiles destroy it, and they destroy more than the poetry. All over America, all over Europe, in fact, cities and towns are under assault by the automobile. They are literally being destroyed by car culture. Cities are gradually learning they don't have to let it happen to them. Witness our beautiful new Embarcadero. We tried for years to get it torn down, and we always lost in the election. Finally, the earthquake did it for us. For another destroyer of poetry and peace, how about those killing machines, the Navy's Blue Angels? Who have just carried out their annual attack on the city. But the poetic life requires peace, not war. The poetic life of the city, our subjective life, that is. The subjective life of the individual is constantly under attack by all the forces of materialist civilization, by all the forces of our military-industrial perplex. And we don't need these warplanes designed to kill and ludicrously misnamed the Blue Angels. They dive upon our city every year in a frightening militarist and nationalist display of pure male testosterone. I've seen old Vietnam ladies in Washington Square diving under the benches. Do we really need to be reminded yearly how our planes have bombed third world countries back to the Stone Age? Perhaps the city could disinvite them this next year. I could go on until I'm singing to your snores, but I'll mention just one more destroyer: chain stores or chain gangs. As the Bay Guardian call them. Corporate chain stores wipe out long-established independence, killing off local color, local traditions, and in the cases of bookstores, literary history. I've been to other great cities on poetry tours and found not a single independent bookstore left in neighborhoods where chain gangs have moved in. It's an old story by now, but it's time to revise a lot of old stories. If so much of this city's population doesn't want chain stores, as the Bay Guardian suggests, why can't the city government take a united stand against them? Yes. But to get to the positive side of things, I have quite a wish list for the city. I propose that North Beach, with its long literary history, be officially protected as a historic district in the manner of the French Quarter in New Orleans. And I propose that a small wooden house on Treasure Island or in the Presidio be made a poet's cottage where future laureates might live or work and conduct poetry events, or even an annual city poetry festival. And since we're in the main library, let's remember that the center of literate culture in cities has always centered in the great libraries, as well as in the independent bookstores. This library should have $10 million a year to spend on books, more than twice as much as presently allotted. It also needs more space already, since evidently this new state of the computer postmodern masterpiece doesn't have as much shelf space as the old library next door. Other outrageous things on my wish list include, one, give bicycles and pedestrians absolute priority over automobiles. And close much of the original inner city to cars completely. Including Upper Grand Avenue, which we tried to do years ago. Two, make the city a center for low-power alternative radio and TV with tax breaks for the broadcasters. Three, uncover our city's creeks and rivers again and open up the riparian corridors to the bay. Five, paint the Golden Gate Bridge golden. I was really disappointed when I came out here. It's painted red lead, and I had enough of that in the Navy. Poets, come out of your closets. Open your windows, open your doors. You have been holed up too long in your closed worlds. No time now for the artist to hide above, beyond, behind the scenes, indifferent, paring his fingernails, refining himself out of existence. No time now for our little literary games, for our paranoias and hypochondrias. No time now for fear and loathing. Time now only for light and love. We have seen the best minds of our generation destroyed by boredom at poetry readings. Etc. This is the first part of a really long diatribe. Anyway, what I had in mind in this populist manifesto in the 1970s was for poets to stop mumbling in their beards and to private audiences and say something important to the world. The manifesto was not a very original Whitmanian call for universal poetry with what I call public surface, a poetry very accessible with a common sensual surface that can be understood by most everyone without a very literary education. But of course, if it was to rise above the level of journalism, it must have other subjective and or subversive levels. Well, I'm still on the same kick. Most poets today still exist in a kind of poetry ghetto. They get pittances to publish poems compared to prose writers, even in mass media, if they manage to get in at all. And poetry readings don't begin to pay the rent for most. What to do about it? How to get poetry out of the poetry ghetto? The answer is obvious. Write poems that say something supremely original and supremely important, which everyone aches to hear. Poetry that cries out to be heard. Poetry that's news. And is it naive to think that even the mass media might print it or air it if it were a new kind of news? Perhaps the poets would still be ignored by our dominant culture because they're saying just what our materialist, technophiliac world doesn't want to hear. And the messenger with the unwelcome message will continue to be killed? I would like to propose a regular monthly column in a daily newspaper with the title Poetry is News. It would begin with great poems of the past that still are news. I think right off of Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. And I think of the French poet Jacques Prévert, whom I translated when I was a student in France. Two of his, The Discourse on Peace. Near the end of an extremely important discourse, the great man of state, stumbling on a beautiful hollow phrase, falls over it, and undone with gaping mouth, shows his teeth, and the dental decay of his peaceful reasoning exposes the nerve of war, the delicate question of money. Quartier Libre, the free zone. I put my cap in the cage and went out with a bird on my head. So one no longer salutes, asked the commanding officer. No, one no longer salutes, replied the bird. Ah, good. Excuse me, I thought one saluted, said the commanding officer. You are fully excused. Everybody makes mistakes, said the bird. Above and beyond all this, poetic intuition and the intuitions of great poetry still remain our best medium for fathoming man's fate. In this vein, here are a few proposed subjects for poets to ponder. Why is it dark at night? Is every orgasm a little death or a little birth? Is death male or female or neither? La vida es sueño? Is life literally a dream? And if so, when will we truly awake? And I'll read some more San Francisco poems. I saw one of them. I saw one of them sleeping, huddled under cardboard by the Church of St. Francis. I saw one of them rousted by the priest. I saw one of them squatting in bushes. I saw another staggering against the plate glass window of a first-class restaurant. I saw one of them in a phone booth shaking it. I saw one with burlap feet. I saw one in a grocery store come out with a pint. I saw another come out with nothing. I saw another putting a rope through the loops of his pants. I saw one with a bird on his shoulder. I saw one of them singing on the steps of City Hall in the so cool city of love. I saw one of them trying to give a lady cop a hug. I saw another sleeping by the Brooklyn Bridge. I saw another standing by the Golden Gate. The view from there was great. This is a poem I wrote in Prague in May. Prague is a great place these days. Andrei Kudrescu, who is here tonight, he was there this summer. He didn't get the same impression I did. I found it's like the 60s just happened there. The intellectuals and the artists who were all in jail under the dictatorship, now running the cultural scene, and the artists seem to be rushing around full of great ideas and excited. They haven't had time to get cynical and disillusioned the way the French are. This poem came to me in the middle of the night, so I'll end with this. Rivers of light, my mind is racing in the middle of the night. My mind races through the darkness around the world. Through the darkness of the world, toward a tunnel of light. It races through the night of Prague, through Staromak Square, with its Jan Hus sculpture, reading Love Each Other and the Truth Will Triumph. It races on through the night streets, across the Charles Bridge, across the river at the heart of Prague, across the rivers of the world, across the Rhine, across the Rhone, across the Seine, across the Thames, across Atlantic, across Manhattan, across Great Hudson, into the heart of America. My heart is racing now, across America, across Old Man River, rolling along. Where is the light? My heart is racing now, across terrific Pacific, across the river of yellow light of Sun Yat-sen, across Gandhi's Ganges, across Euphrates, across the Nile, across the Hellespont, across Tiber, across Arno, across Dante's River Styx, through the medieval darkness, into the heart of the tunnel of light. My heart and mind are racing now, together on the same beat, to the same music. It's not the music of Carmina Burano. It's the music of Don Giovanni. It's Mozart's horn concerto. It's the yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. There is a sign in the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm trying to read it. We are all trying to read it. Dark figures dancing it in the half darkness. Light figures dancing it in the half light.
That was Lawrence Ferlinghetti's acceptance speech. In 1998, he became the first poet laureate of the city of San Francisco. His words turned out to be prophetic. Now, 3 years later, much of San Francisco has indeed become a corporate town. In my own neighborhood, in the Mission District, the sky has become obscured by condominiums and office buildings, and they have displaced low-income folks and small businesses. Our local restaurants are now filled with yuppies, and they're served by waiters who can no longer afford to live in the city. Tune in next week at the same time to hear about the vibrant movement that joined in the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition. They print beautiful posters, occupy buildings, and fight the city planners, and have had their first successes. You can get a copy of Ferlinghetti's speech with next week's program on how to fight growth and protect urban housing for $12. Your tape order helps us continue our work. For a credit card order, call us anytime, toll-free, 1-877-GUC-TAPE. That's 877-GUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.